call the meeting to order. And ask Dr. Dennison to call the vote.
Dr. Philip Bale.
Present.
Dr. Barbara Birch.
Here.
Ms. Cynthia Harris.
Here.
Mr. Brady Hinton.
Here.
Mr. Gil Johnson.
Here.
Mr. James Kennedy.
Present.
Mr. David Porter.
Present.
Mr. John Rickles.
Here.
Ms. Nikki Taylor.
Here.
Mr. Larry Zell.
In attendance. I changed a little bit. Or is it then? All right.
I do. I have a few things that kind of exciting in recent weeks, and I'll end with an introduction for you. You all are aware of our near conclusion of our accreditation reaffirmation visit. Jordan will touch on that in a moment. I think most of you saw a ranking that came out about 2 weeks ago from an organization called Smart Asset, a financial organization that ranked the colleges and universities, public and private, in Kentucky, according to a series of measures, average scholarships and grants, starting salary and graduation tuition, what we call retention rate. And so they were wanting to rank institutions where you get a good education for a good price. The rankings were University of Kentucky, Western Kentucky University, University of Louisville, Murray State, Pennsylvania, Eastern Kentucky, Morehead State Union, Northern Kentucky, and Thomas More College. So we are very pleased about how we fare in value for cost by an independent financial organization. So that says a lot about our value and our price point as well. We'll celebrate engineering a little bit here, but we won't elaborate when we take some engineering action, but just know that our civil engineering group had an incredible performance in the regional competitions, first overall in the concrete canoe competition, first overall in the steel bridge building, first overall in what's called balsa wood bridge, first in geotechnical engineering, and third overall in surveying. And very proud of how they performed in our regional competition. And just so you know, the institutions in the regional competition were Akron, Carnegie Mellon, Cincinnati, Cincinnati State, Cleveland State, Dayton, Geneva College, University of Louisville, University of Kentucky, Ohio, Ohio State, Pittsburgh, and Youngstown State. And we were runaway winner, finishing first in that regional competition. Now we move on to the national competition and all of those rather curious engineering events. So yes, it floats. Concrete canoes are terrific. So, whatever that's worth. Gainer Newman? Stand up, Gainer. Gainer's had a good month, to say the least. Gainer is the coach of our American Association National Championship Forensics team about 3 weeks ago, and just this last weekend, winner of the National Forensics Association Championship and the Lincoln Douglas Debate Championship as well. An incredible performance, and isn't it cool to be the first in American higher education in an important academic endeavor? Congratulations, Gainer. Well done, my man. I would also call to your attention that the Washington Post just announced a few days ago the most challenging high schools in the nation, and they weren't ranked, but the Gatton Academy was ranked in that top group of about a dozen high schools in America that do the greatest job of producing graduates under the greatest rigor. And that's an important vote of confidence in the Gatton Academy in addition to all the other accolades. Best college reviews, the top 20 online RN to BSN, registered nurse to Bachelor of Science in Nursing programs in America. And we were in that top 20. They were listed in alphabetical order. So great things are continuing to unfold all across this campus. It's a salute to what our faculty and staff are doing day in, day out to achieve our bold vision for WKU. before my introduction, I just acknowledge to the group that the following are facts of a reaffirmation visit. I had a conversation with Dale Whalen, who is the president of the Southern Association of the Colleges and Schools Commission on Colleges, and she will be joining us for our board retreat in July. She'll be with us on Thursday afternoon, and so it would be an honor to have the head of our accrediting agency for the southeastern United States with us for our board retreat. So just wanted to pass it on. She had a great conversation with her a week ago, and actually David suggested that we invite her to come in and speak with our board, and good suggestion. She's honored, and she will be here with us on Thursday. Finally, to introduce our next student body president, SGA president, and our student regent, J. Todd Richards. Stand up, J. Todd. J. Todd is a sophomore from Glasgow, Kentucky, and after only 2 years, he's already accomplished about 8 years' worth of achievements at this university. He's majoring in political science, economics, and Asian studies and culture, and he is a member of our Chinese flagship program. He's a member of the Honors College. He's treasurer of our College Democrats. He's a member of Phi Gamma Delta Fraternity. He's chair of our WKU Student Coalition for Renters' Rights, and is doing incredible things. And the U.S. Department of State is working with us, and we are proud that Jay Todd will be serving as an intern in the Public Affairs section of the U.S. Embassy in Beijing this summer. Jay Todd Ritchie, our new student regent. Maybe you want to be the faculty regent. Our new student regent, Jay Todd Ritchie, and Melissa's patience. Finally, I can't believe I'm going to skip right over these notes, but in my comments in here is the news from, that thing's flipped together, man, I apologize to Christian Ryan, and I hit it in my notes, I flipped together here, I'm sorry, Christian Ryan, stand up. U.S. Department of Education Green Ribbon School Post-Secondary Education Sustainability Awardee, and the U.S. Department of Education selected a number of schools, mostly secondary schools, public and private, to receive the Green Ribbon Award, and they only picked nine universities in America. We first had to be selected among all the colleges and universities in Kentucky to be put forth as Kentucky's candidate for the Green Ribbon Award, and then we had to compete with every state's higher education candidate to be selected for those, to be among those nine as the institutions that are doing the most in the name of sustainability, conservation, and behavior that will lead to a planet that we can all enjoy for many generations to come. And it starts at home. And Christian Ryan Downing is our sustainability coordinator, and this is a big deal. She'll be, among others, in Washington in another month or two to celebrate the actual receiving of these accolades, including the White House. So congratulations, Christian. Great leadership, great job, and an award well-deserved. And again, another example of this vision of a leading American university with international reach being achieved. Great job.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Academic Affairs Committee had what we affectionately termed as an epic meeting, and we talked about a lot of new programs, and we will have them on the consent agenda unless anyone objects to that, and I am going to pull one item and ask Regent Birch to talk about our maritime positions.
Thank you. I'm pleased to present our maritime couples today.
That's okay. Well, can I make a few remarks first?
Thank you.
Following on from Gary's most recent announcement on the Green Ribbon Designation, I want to stress that it's not, yes, it's for sustainability, but also for a healthy campus. We'd like to encourage more folks to get into health care involved, and also educationally, several faculty involved in the three pillar structure of that. So, particularly interesting award, I wanted the board to be aware of that. When I left the CPE meeting last Friday, I took a wrong turn on I-64 while Gary headed back to Bowling Green, and I went to Athens, Ohio, to watch part of our forensics team compete. I was uniformly impressed with the entire competition. I could not tell the difference. All these young men and women from all over the United States did an outstanding job, and to be ranked number one by a significant margin. We beat UT Austin by 4 points. At AFA, we beat them how many games at AFA? 107. Yeah, it was very significant, and then to be ranked number one in that group, I'm very, very proud. This is the time of the year on campus where we celebrate all kinds of things. And yesterday we had our reception for our 26 faculty award winners throughout the colleges in the areas of teaching, research, creativity, public service, and student advisement. The university award winners will be recognized at commencement, and then will receive their awards at convocation in the fall, which I think is a wonderful link from one academic year to the next. Last but not least, I'm sleeping a little better now that the SAC COC on-site team has departed. They departed with two recommendations for us to consider, and I'll ask Gary to mention those in a minute, but they're very readily addressable. One relates to the assessment plan for the QEP, and one relates to the assessment for academic programs in general. We are anxiously awaiting the article in the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal did send a reporter to observe and visit. Anxious to see how that comes up. But the SAC team also is allowed to make what they call optional comments, and they don't have to make any comments beyond how we address the 90-something principles, but they chose to make some optional comments, and I think they're all very positive, and they address not only the conscientious and thorough approach that the entire campus had to this process, but also the hospitality that we showed the team during their visit. It's not over yet. We still have to respond to those two recommendations. We will have a deans and department heads work day on June 17 to, amongst other things, produce a response to the assessment question. I'm very confident we can do a good job on that. But again, most of us are sleeping a lot better now, and I'm going to have Gary to say a few words about the
I was going to give Jeff this to copy and hand to everyone, but it lists you hate to dwell on the two recommendations that they made out of 97 when 95 were, wow, you all are great, that kind of thing. But I'll share this with you. One recommendation dealt with assessment of our certification programs particularly, and that's an evolving dynamic in our Division of Extended Learning and Outreach. And then the other dealt with assessment of our quality enhancement plan, and their suggestion there was maybe we were a little more complex and challenging in assessing our QEP, our quality enhancement plan, evidence and argument. And they were suggesting we simplify it a little bit, which was very helpful. And then they made some other comments that we found very encouraging. So I'll copy this and send it around for everyone if you can make 30 or 40 of that. But it was a great experience, and as a board, we may not have a feel for the amount of work and effort that goes into a reaffirmation visit. You do it every 10 years. And this entire campus for about 2 years was, I won't say consumed, but for some, consumed. Right, Rich? But it is a healthy exercise because you assess everything and you know you've got to meet your standards. There would be nothing more devastating to an institution than to fail to achieve reaffirmation by an accreditation visiting team of peers from other institutions who can be completely objective, and everything they know they
read in the materials that they're presented. So it's a rigorous process, and Gordon has been incredible in not only tracking this, but tracking details and staying with it and personally being engaged in nearly every aspect of this accreditation process, which is good because so many of them are academic in context. Most of them are. There are sections for board governance, and there are sections for student life and advancement and all the other areas. And I do want to thank David and Philip and Melissa for joining some of the committee that was here, the leadership of the committee, for lunch to talk about the board and board governance. So it was a great process with a terrific ending, and we'll report back in a couple of months on these two recommendations, and then we'll go before the SACS COC, Southern Association of College and Schools Commission on Colleges, board, I guess in December, for final action, and that's just the way that process works. So great job by so many people, and Gordon particularly, you and Rich coordinated so much of the activities. So both of you, congratulations, and to everybody involved in that process.
Just one quick comment. I know several of you have been around and looked through in the process. This is an amazing outcome. Every year there are some things that nationally serve a concern, and I would say every institution gets an assessment. And so you could almost predict there was going to be something, and that was the most logical. And I also suggested that the courage to have someone from the Wall Street Journal present probably precipitated even more rigor in the visit, than, even though it's rigorous enough, knowing that this was going to be a saccharine display with the press with us. So I think it's a remarkable outcome. Staff did a great job of it.
Yeah, they not the Wall Street Journal, but the SACS staff, the vice president, Robert Conklin, who was coordinating our visit, called a month out and said, we've got a request from the Wall Street Journal reporter who would like to come on the visit to WKU and write a story about higher education accreditation. And, you know, that's a little bit risky when you say, sure, bring them on. You never know how that might, where that might lead. But he did a lot of interviews. I spent an hour with him, I guess. And so we'll see. I don't know when that story will appear, but sometime in the next few weeks, I would presume. He's put a lot of time and effort into it. And I think in some sense he was taking a critical eye, having a critical eye on the whole accreditation dynamic. And the federal government invests a lot of money, and the federal government have confidence in the accreditation process to be sure that the federal investment, 40% of our students are on Pell Grants, federal money, for example, are the standards by which higher education is measured sufficient to earn the investment that the federal government is placing in higher education. That was his general theme, and we were the example. We'll see. We'll let you know how that one turns out, but I think it'll be fine. I think we'll fare very well, because every time the committee bragged on us, he was there taking notes. So we'll send that to you as soon as it appears. Thank you, Commissioner Barbara. I forgot about the Wall Street Journal being here.
Thank you. So much good news. I don't think any academic committee in America could have more good news than what we have today, particularly the programs that we're passing. And it's extra sweet. I'll point out that I think Gainer is a product of WKU, and the next generation on is even more special. At this time, Bruce Birch, I'll ask you to make a few comments about our maritime campus.
We have four maritime today that are in the and I do not know nothing. I don't think so. that doesn't make any less honor. So, the first one is Dr. Rick Easter. Rick is a professor of education administration in the College of Education and Behavioral Sciences. He has served in just about every capacity. He's been leadership in the department, college, associate dean in the college, university level. He is highly regarded at the present time, before his retirement, full-time. Rick was also one of the core five of the MBA Leadership Doctoral Program. He is an exemplary professor in being able to make online learning come alive in ways that our doctoral students are really pleased. And he probably is credit for getting an awful lot of them through on some of the technical side of it. He's worked in K-12 education as an advisor. That's where his research agenda has been, and he has truly been a leader in many ways, nationally, held positions, and so I'm very pleased that we're on the Rick as an American faculty
member.
And a dog is not what's wrong with him there,
yeah, no.
But I don't really drink scotch, so that's it. Mr. Bart White, professor of broadcasting journalism, broadcasting school journalism, and broadcasting. I think just about everybody knows Bart in some way or another. He taught courses in broadcast communication here for 35 years. And in addition to that, he has advised hundreds and hundreds of broadcasting students. He's been an author and has written chapters and co-authored and books. He was, before coming here, a radio station manager and public affairs director in Illinois. And he retired in 2013 at the end of the year, 2013-14. But if you don't know Bart any other way from his exemplary accomplishments, perhaps you will know that he's one of those wonderful voices that calls out the students' names and names. Dr. Mitzi Grimm, professor of music, is the third professor that we're presenting today. Mitzi has just been incredible with her accomplishments at the stations at the university. She was here for 12 years as department head, full professor. During that time, the department went through lots of changes, including NASM accreditation, which was a first for Western to get that accreditation and a major deal. And also the redesign of the Master of Music degree, and she helped with the planning and construction of the Music Rehearsal Hall, which sits so proudly up on top of the hill. She's an outstanding teacher, administrator. She was a sensitive, demanding person, and just the best in every way. And unless you don't know this, she was the first one, I think, that Dr. Ramsdale let go into the governor's tire and play the music. So she had a lot to do with setting that tradition.
She's a Carolyn Ewer. A new word for you. Ed, that's a new word. But she's a Carolyn Ewer. Board for Justice Tower is in the academic complex in that third window on the upper floor right there. And when it's played a keyboard, there's about a 7-second lag between the E and you hear the bell. But she's already about 3 lines ahead in the keyboard, and she has to tune out what the actual sound is. She's not quite skilled.
Now, this is an interruption to the presentation, but I can't resist. Sharing with you a note of humor in that his bells first started ringing, and at that time our president suggested that having commencement out in the middle of a hot football field was a good idea. And as we walked off the field, he was just really smug about the fact that he had a little clicker and was going to click it, and the music would start playing. And it was funny watching Gary, he clicked. And he took, nothing happened. It was this long delay. And I think before we got to the gate going on the field, it finally started with this great sigh of relief. So, Mitzi, having a live person in there was a real benefit. And the last person that I'm pleased to present for you is Dr. Barry Brunson. Dr. Brunson was absolutely known as an innovative and exceptional teacher in math. He was dedicated to his students. And he was a model teacher in every way. He was one of the first users of technology in the classroom and one of the first professors to stress use of Mathematica in his courses, which means something to the mathematicians in the room and people like that. He was huge in serving the department and also served as chair of the Kentucky section of Mathematics Association of America. And so all of these four were wonderful, wonderful contributors, and it's my pleasure to present it to you.
I believe we also enjoy the president's recommendation, and with that, I'll ask for a vote. All those in favor of these appointments, say aye.
I think we need a motion. We do have a motion
from Regan Birch, I believe.
Did you make it?
I really didn't, but I should.
You get a second.
I'll second.
All those in favor say aye. Opposed, like sign. Motion passes. I think we have some visitors who wish to come in the room before we address the rest of our consideration.
We've already bragged on winning the regional competition and all the different endeavors. That freshman with the light hair.
We being engineers, it's okay to touch each other. We're all here.
Very good. We have the rest of our Academic Affairs Committee is on a consent agenda, and we're going to have items AA1 to AA6 and then AA8. And is there anyone that would like to pull anything else out from that agenda?
Yes. Major Bill, before we make a motion, I'd like to ask Cheryl Stevens and the department head, Julie Ellis, to introduce a few guests we have coming up.
Very good.
We have a large number of folks. If you are a student, a current student in Dunham County Engineering, wave your right hand.
Aren't they good at following instructions?
Very, very good. So we also have faculty members, current faculty members, Professor Shane Thomas, Professor Warren Campbell, Professor Farhan Ashrafzadeh, Professor Marteza Nurchesme, who is also, we believe, the newest permanent resident of the United States of America. He just received his green card approval, and we're really pleased. Professor Mark Cameron back there. Jason Wilson, who is a technician and also a graduate of the very first class of WKU Engineering 2004, is our newest member of staff. Chris Byrne right here. Joel Lenore right here. Troy Robertson right there. And we have some long-term friends. Bud Lane, I think many of you know Bud. Know that the support of people like Bud, Jim Scott, Bahal, the Grelix, those folks, Mark and Ritter, other folks, as well as many, many, many other people, made the very beginning of WKU Engineering happen. And no one did more or put more miles on his vehicle or on President Ransell's ear than John Russell. Yeah. So, we're just here to observe and witness this moment.
Well,
we're really glad to be here.
It's great to have you all here. And much of what we talk about and much of what a university is supposed to do is produce some translational results, things that really translate into the public sector, and I may put Bud on the spot and have him recount how many engineer students we had 20 years ago and what it is today. And because, Bud, you employ a lot of
them. Yes, I do. Johnny, correct me if I'm wrong, there was about 12 in that area about 20 years ago, something close to that.
The first group of graduates, Joel may remember it better than I, but I thought it was less than a few of them, about 9, 7.
Yeah.
The first group.
You 12 know, mechanicals. There were 3 electricals, and there were 4.
Our first class is fewer than
20. And now we have 720 students,
I believe. In the fall, we have 720. And as of this next commencement, there will be more than 600 graduates of the WKU engineering programs added to the more than 1,000 graduates of the predecessor programs in engineering technology.
All of which that have jobs.
And one of our grads, Jesse Reeser, has been hired to be at Spantech. And he will start there,
sure.
I think, the day after commencement.
Hallelujah.
Okay, great. Anyone have any comments? I don't want this to overshadow the other 6 items on here, much of which are medical, healthcare related, all of which are 6 and have translational as well as some of them transformational values, but I think it's a great example of a university that's moving forward in very tangible, very important ways. It's great to have all here. Anyone wish to make a motion or Bridget Johnson?
Session.
Second. Birch. Any other discussion?
I think it's nice that I read that all the professors are PEs. You know, right?
That is correct.
So that's the only university that has that?
That is correct.
Not UK, not UL?
Not anyone else in the United States or any place else in the world.
Congratulations.
Any other comments?
It is not the economic development driver of this region of Kentucky, along with a lot of other professions, particularly in healthcare, but this one is all about jobs. When we started the program, we were 0.6 engineers per thousand in Kentucky, and our goal is to get 1.6, and we're contributing to the achievement of that statistic.
Do we keep statistics on how well our students do at the PE test?
We do.
Is it good?
We do fairly well. It's a little difficult to track because we just get the results aggregate, and so if someone takes it more than once, I can't tell that. But roughly, we do pretty well, and especially in civil engineering, where most of the graduates are headed down that trail. If somebody's in industry, in electrical or mechanical, they're not required to have that credential, so that doesn't happen. But our numbers are at or slightly above the national average, which I can use.
Okay.
Cheryl, do you have
any? We're so proud.
Okay. That's good enough.
I can't add any more to it.
I'll call the question. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Mr. Chairman, I think unless the provost has anything else to say, that concludes the business of the academic committee.
Congratulations.
But I want to invite everybody here and everybody in the peanut gallery and everybody on May 13th, the Wednesday of finals week, the engineering department has its spring expo where you will see some of those translational and transformational projects. Everything from the things that our first year students do, balsa wood bridges, little bugs that follow lines, strange tennis ball launchers at something, to what our seniors are doing, making a difference in research results, as well as projects that are meaningful to local and far away industry. So, Wednesday the 13th of May, the Wednesday finals week, engineering, and there's always barbecue in the middle of the day.
All right.
Thank you.
Feel like a porter.
Thanks, bud.
Johnny, have a good day.
Philip, I'm glad you did acknowledge the other six programs because patient navigator, neuroscience, nurse practitioner, psychiatric mental health, the clinical community behavioral health, all critically important.
Those are some exciting programs.
Thank you.
We're going to go now to item number three. This is the first committee report. And we come back to the finance committee. That means that we have taken our
you need unanimous approval to change the order of the agenda that's published.
Any motion?
No, not motion. Everybody,
you take the agenda.
We had a lengthy discussion in the last of the meeting, and at this time, I will actually what was in your packet was incorrect, so I'd like to read the motion as it should read. I'm seeking a motion for approval to establish a new fee of $30 for full-time students, prorated part-time students for construction as a part of the
move it option.
Second. We have a motion and a second. At this time, is there any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed?
All agenda items have been discussed in committee, and the committee consists of myself as chair, Regent Hayden, Regent Johnson, Regent Kennedy, and Regent Zelke, in a pre-meeting earlier last month, and we reached on March the 27th. And I will point out it was with a very passionate, spirited discussion. With input from many of the members of this body that do not actually serve on the committee, so there was a lot of input put into our finance and budget to indeed. Is there anyone who wishes to remove any of the items from the consent agenda?
Are you looking at, I'm sorry, Mr. Lee, are you looking at all of the agenda items?
All agenda items under the we have a consent agenda, and I'm asking, is there anyone who would like to move any of the action items from the consent agenda?
Including tuition fees.
All of them are on the list,
I would like
yes.
to remove that.
And that is, just for clarification, FD5?
Yes.
There's been a request to remove that. Is there any further requests? If not, I would like to offer a motion to approve the consent agenda excluding FD5.
So moved. Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
And for record's sake, I'll need to make sure that the records show that I abstained from the consent agenda vote.
All right. FD5 is up for discussion.
Do I need a motion, Dr. Capps, to open discussion on that item?
To approve. I move the approval of FD5.
Second.
It's open for discussion.
Yes.
Motion's on the table. Open for discussion.
Do you want to jump back in? Okay.
You have the floor, Dr. Burks, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Burks. I specifically want to talk about two items on the agenda under the mandatory student, or three actually, under the mandatory student fees. I know that both the faculty senate and SGA passed a resolution on approaching the athletic fees, and I've said anything we'll talk about it, but I would like to be a little bit more specific as to why. I think that it's important to recall a few years ago when the commitment was made by this board that student athletics would be removed from Pepe and would be fee-based based on student enrollments. And the drop in student enrollments has unquestionably had a very negative impact on athletic funding, I have no doubt. But it's had a negative impact on funding across the campus. And I think it is not sending a very good message to single out athletics to increase that fee at a time when everybody else is suffering in the same way. I would also point out several other things. Right now, I think we have to look at the athletic fee in the context of the larger funding for athletics. 70% of the athletic funding that is not foundation supported is subsidized by this university. And that's a considerable amount. I realize that you're in a conference with 14 other schools, but actually, that is the third highest of all the subsidies that universities provide for athletics. Western is the third highest, but 70%. And I just do not see how we can find a case for subsidizing when everything else on campus is equally being affected by the change in enrollments. Last point I would make is that when you look at the agenda that was just passed in terms of salary increases and additional payments, there's $68,000 in salary increases for athletic coaches in next year out of the UNG budget.
We're talking specifically about this motion and not salaries.
Yes, I am. It is relevant. I think I'll make that point.
Okay.
And at a time when athletics says that the enrollment drop is making it difficult for them to get by, I think being able to put $68,000 in salary increases out of EMG doesn't make sense. I mean, I don't know how you can put those salary increases forward when you need your money from the fee. All in all, I think there's strong feeling among faculty on this campus. James will talk about the staff, I'm sure. But this singles out one unit for increase, which is dependent on student fees, when no other unit is singled out. And I think that's not a good message to send. I think it's a priority that takes away from other priorities.
Mr. Irwin, may I offer some...
Well, I have a question for Dr. Burks. So that I understand, not the committee chair, but I understand. So you're saying then if this increase does not take place, then we also want to look at a decrease in all the student fees for funding of all departments. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not asking to decrease the athletic fee. I'm saying that increasing it singles it out for new money at a time when every department on campus is being cut.
Well, actually, that's not true because I'm increasing the student fees based on the CPE number.
I'm sorry?
As we increase the cost of the CPE budget that we're applying for, there are other fees that are going up as well.
The only other fee going up this time is the garage fee, which is new, and a $2 student center fee. Yes.
So there is some increases in other areas.
I think, Mr. Ridley, my point is I'm not opposing student center fee for $2 because I think this campus just constructed the Downing building and it's pretty obvious. It has no revenue generating capacity. It just doesn't have revenue generating capacity. And so $2 is pretty obvious. You're going to need a little more money to operate that building. Athletics, contrary to many units on campus, athletics does have revenue generating capacity. And we don't ever see.
I don't think anybody will deny that.
That's right.
That's the business model for that fund. But at the same time, I would caution Regent Burgess to use words like subsidize. And specifically that word, because in my own opinion, we could also say that to the theater department, performing arts, the music hall. I mean, we are trying to look at this university as a holistic environment and not necessarily singling out one department over another to pit them against each other. And when that happens, that's a very slippery slope. And I just want to caution you, as a finance chair,
I would agree.
I think that we need to look at the university as a holistic approach rather than constantly looking at one department or the other. Because once that happens, then there are many people outside of the university environment that would want to start nitpicking, if I can use that word, on specific areas of the university that they may not think is important.
I do want to
point that out, that subsidizing is a very...
I would agree with you completely.
Very debatable.
And as a holistic approach, I'm suggesting that if we are going to single out athletics to increase that fee, we ought to look at others. However, let me speak to subsidy, okay? We do subsidize. We subsidize everything on this campus. But I would point out to you that when you look at the $156 million or whatever the budget is for academics, and you divide that by the number of students that we serve, you will find that $8,463 per student is the subsidy, if you want to call it that.
No, I do not want to call it that.
Well, it's being supported, okay? When you look at the amount of money that is subsidizing athletics, there are two ways of looking at it. One is the entire $22 million budget. If you look at it that way, the subsidy for every one of the athletic students is $70,823. If you look at just the part of that that is direct university subsidy that the athletic department doesn't contribute to, it's still almost $60,000. So I'm suggesting right now, and by the way, I'm going to have to pay more for athletics than you do academics. I accept that. I'm not arguing about it. I'm not suggesting athletics doesn't need money. I'm not even suggesting that's out of line because I don't know all the other figures. What I do know is that to single out athletics, once there has been an agreement that they're going to be dependent on student fees, to single that out and say, now we're going to give them an increase, since it's a hard time with student fees, when no one else in the university on the academic side is going to be bailed out, I think that is prioritizing athletics in a way that is not a healthy move for us. But Mr. Ridley,
I want to call in and read our...
And I'd like to just offer three clarifying points. Approving this fee going from 212 to 218 is not a budget increase for athletics. It is reducing the deficit that they will be required to cover. My estimate is that the deficit will be reduced to $170,000, rather than $443,000. The fee is assessed fall, spring, winter, summer, in any decline in enrollment over the last few years. It impacts the athletic budget. So some of those variables have been postponed in hopes that enrollment would return to a previous level of about fall 11 or fall 10. And so number one, the fee increase reduces the deficit associated with the athletic fee. Number two, athletics participates in two budget reductions based reallocations. And every time that we've brought to you a reduction based reallocation plan in the operating budget, one is the change in the student athletic fee. However, we've been covering that through athletics with one-time money rather than actually bringing the budget with the reduction. Now we want to change that to get the base correct. But the second thing that is that when we had a reduction in state funding or fluctuations in enrollment requiring us to adjust our budget, as we are going to do for next year, athletics participates in that piece as well. So when we bring you a budget for approval for fiscal year 16, it will include two components of an athletics budget reduction. The third piece that I need to comment on is interinstitutional comparisons are always challenging to get your apples to apples. And I believe that athletics now, as they establish more working relationships with Conference USA counterparts, will work to try to get a data set that is comparable. When you do interinstitutional comparisons, one variable that always causes problems is to what degree there's a debt obligation in your numbers or not. And is it shown as an athletics debt or is it an athletics lease for example, the Diddle Arena facility that's a multi-use facility. So what we're committed to do is over the next year to make sure that you do have a reasonable comparison among other Conference USA institutions.
And that so debt obligation,
the three points that I wanted to make.
The debt obligation for the physical structure is how much of that number?
Oh, my goodness.
35%.
Yeah, it's about, yeah.
It's 35%.
It's at 2.8.
I mean, it's of the $212 fee, approximately $85 of that goes directly to debt.
So our fee does include the continual lease payment to the city of Bowling Green. We're not at a point to be able to say that other institutions have handled any debt obligation, lease obligation, consistently as we had reported, the current $212.
So, in a way, the $30 fee that the students agreed to do the parking structure could be equated to the $85 of the fee to pay the debt obligation for Diddle Arena. Is that a comparison?
They're both debt.
They're both debt obligations. So in one way, the student government has agreed to have a fee to expand their facilities, and in this example of Diddle Arena, that was agreed on some time ago. Would that be a good comparison?
Yes. And I understand that if you take out the debt service, we're not the third largest.
We need to understand that better to what our rank really is from a competitive standpoint when you adjust for the fact that we do know that we have debt in our number. And not everyone has done that. As you learn more about other institutions, for example, one Conference USA member doesn't have an athletic fee at all. Do you think that they don't subsidize, if we use Dr. Burch's word, subsidize? There is obviously a decision on how much the institution is going to allocate beyond the revenue that can be generated by that program. But they don't report a fee. So I'll work with athletics, and we will work over the next year to have a better understanding of how our funding for athletics compares to those tier institutions.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Yes.
I want to add to what Anne's saying, because I did a little analysis of this myself. I was first going to make a comment about the $85, but that goes to academics as well. We have the ROTC program there. And we have classes there, and certainly have university functions such as commencement. If you look at the last 5 years, an athletic department has taken a cut of over $550,000. So I think they are obviously paying their fair share. And if you look at the overall budget, academics is 39.93%, and the athletic department is only 5.64% of that budget. So, you can have a very significant effect if we don't proceed the way the Finance Committee had originally voted on this last year.
Any more discussion?
Just one very quick comment.
Sure.
On Ann's deficit covered, I would only point out to you, there's probably not a unit on campus that wouldn't work to return to the 10-11 budget. Not a unit on campus. So, we can call it deficit covered, but the fact is that everybody has. My last comment is that as it's not unusual for any school with Division I football to find themselves increasingly expensive. And I think it would be very helpful at some point to generate people's better understanding of the cost of athletics and the benefits, to get some sense of what the real costs are. When we went into Division I football, we were told this was going to generate more revenue, more donors, more enrollments. And if we knew that in fact that happened, I think it would bring better understandings on the part of the campus. But maybe that's something we could have a report on sometime.
I'm certainly to explore that. I will point out that we haven't been in this conference for a very short time, so it's going to be really hard to measure that on a very short period. I bet expect to see the enrollment and so forth.
Let me add one thought, and I'm not engaging in the conversation about this speed in particular, but I do want to point out some trepidation that this board does not approve, nor do I approve, course fees that academic departments levy on students for a broad range of courses all across our colleges and departments. Many departments levy a course fee on the students. The paper things that that course entails that typically are not covered by the tuition rate or that departmental budget. And I don't get involved in that. I really don't know whether the provost gets involved in that or not.
The provost has approved.
I approve those fees when they are audited internally to make sure that fees are used for the purposes. And the fees go up and down.
Yeah. But that's the departmental prerogative to raise or lower their fees based on their needs in a given year. My job is to be objective and look at all departments equally and have a sense of equity and fairness across our budgeting process. It would be inappropriate to say that academic departments have no means to generate some revenue when in fact many departments do have course fees that do benefit their ability to teach whatever that might be about, because some departments' equipment is expensive. And paying effective departmental budget to take care of all of those costs. So I just.
Last comment, actually. It is true about course fees, and it's the provost said they go up and down. But those fees are directly turned back in for instructional support for the students that are in the class. The user, the payer, is the direct beneficiary. And I think sometimes it's hard to see that. In athletics, and it's very hard to explain what you can afford in addition to salaries in athletics in a time when you don't think we're in a salary.
I think those salaries were redirected to funds within their budget. I do not think they require those to be invested.
Yeah, if I may address that's not accurate. We do not have $68,000 in salary increases. We had a position that was not filled, and we had another person who left. And the replacement was hired at a much lower salary. And so those numbers were reallocated. There is no increased spending in football salaries for 2015 from 2014.
Todd, I don't want to argue with you, but S5, page S5, they are all listed, the 68,000, they are all listed as salary increases. I can tell you specifically later if you want to know which ones. But they say and show salary increases, and they are
it is an increase for the individual.
Reallocation is also listed in that. You don't see the revenue source.
I'm saying if you've got $68,000 to give, that kind of increase to six people, you need the fee to pay it.
There's a long list of personnel actions you all just approved, and most of them are in the academic area.
No, if there's no further questions or
comments. Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a comment. Okay. There are a couple of comments, actually. Bring a little bit of a different perspective to what we've already heard. I realize that this is a very sensitive issue, but I'd like to come to this from a different standpoint. My personal view is athletics as a tremendous recruiting and advertising vehicle, not only for sports, but for Western Kentucky University as a whole. I think it is a wonderful asset that we can work hand in hand with our recruitment efforts. And I feel that there is a gain, as we were talking about, the wholesome image. I feel like there is a universal gain as a whole that contributes to our overall university mission. In our committee meetings last month, I understood it to be that if this fee was not approved, that there could be some academic initiatives, especially in the summer, that could very well be hindered or hurt because of this. And let's all remember, too, that while they are athletes, they are students first. Therefore, I have a little bit of a unique view on that. And let's not try to pit one versus the other. We're all trying to work towards the same goal. And I do feel that this specific fee in particular, I mean, let's face it, you know, advertising can speak volumes. And it, you know, and the residual proceeds can be filtered not just from an athletic point of view. It can be felt throughout the entire university. My two cents.
I'd like to hear what the student agent has to say, what the students are doing.
Yes, for, you know, everyone was on the board, was given the resolution from student government, and I think I will speak to that was a very close vote within student government. It was 15 to 10 of the students who voted to oppose the athletic fee, and I think we offer a different perspective on it from the points that Dr. Roach made. We looked a lot, the ones who did vote in favor of it, to at the fact that now that we're in Conference USA, we are making a significant more amount of revenue than we were making in the Sun Belt. And so from the student perspective, those that voted in favor, that is why they voted in favor. And so I think it's my duty as the president of student government and student region to, you know, express those concerns to you and say from our perspective, that's why we passed the resolution to oppose the athletic fee, was because that we are making a significant amount more in Conference USA than we were making in the Sun Belt. But again, those 10 who voted against did also have a different perspective, especially about the revenue losses that athletics has had in Conference USA. So, just one. I abstained from the vote on the executive cabinet, and so, but I think it's my duty to offer both sides of the story that students had that night when we were discussing it with an SGA.
Call for question.
No further discussion.
Motion's on the table. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Three opposition.
Did you know who they were?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Motion passes. Thank you, ma'am.
Mr. Chairman, that concludes the business of the financing.
Questions? To the executive committee. We have two action items. Number one is the acceptance of the university's 2016-2022 six-year capital plan, page 1-3, and approval of the purchase of 1340 Russellville Road property, page 4-3.
Move the adoption of the EX 182.
Second.
We have to discuss EX 2 because we're not coming to the committee.
I change my motion to EX 1.
See, I said it.
Okay. This is Brad Wheeler, who, among other things, manages the university's property portfolio duties that were previously.
Round one. This is two.
I'm sorry.
Round one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got one. Hang in there, Brad.
Hold on. Let's get here.
Brian.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We have, on April 15th, submitted the six-year capital plan list and all the requirements for the university. I refer to this list as our needs assessment. It is in somewhat of a priority order. And any questions about this? It's a dynamic list at this point. This six-year capital plan process will open back up so that if someone said, oh, I forgot, I need to enter another project. So there's also a method in the process of everything else to Franklin capital plan and models. I can really have another project or something special came up along the way during the process. Any questions?
Right now, we're getting pushed to after $1 billion.
Yes. It's a needs assessment.
So all this will not necessarily happen.
Oh, it's not happening.
That is done. Okay.
In fact, our number one priority, which is number one on the list going into the 2016 General Assembly, is the College of Business project. And we would be most fortunate for capital projects to be in the budget, in the biennial budget in 2016, the state budget, and we get that project funded. And so even anything beyond number one on this list is not likely to happen for 4, 6, or 8 years. And this order sort of may change as we go into the 2018 budget cycle if the College of Business project gets funded in 16. If not, it'll be number one in 2018. But as Brian was suggesting, you can't get a project done unless it's on this list, even if you get private money to do it, or federal money, or some other source.
This list is actually a requirement of state government that we have to submit. I'll give a really good example is that when you have a high voltage cable fail in the middle of winter, it's our number two priority. And that project has been on the list asking the state to make it for our infrastructure for over 10 years. And we have been self-funding each summer replacing the high voltage system. But this also covers things that, again, we're going to see. It's the stormwater, it's natural gas, it's our water system, it's our infrastructure of any kind that you don't see on the ground. So it's very important that we create this list. It's part of our deferred capital maintenance program, and anything that's over $600,000 is required to be put on the list. Again, if we don't have this list put together, we can't receive authorization through the budget process. This next, we have to go each time up to the state.
And just so the board knows, of particular importance to you as a board are the items in the agency bond category, because that would entail university debt. Now, we just approved the parking structure, which is the number three item on the list. Which has to be on the list if the General Assembly is to approve that project in 2016 for an agency bond. The General Assembly still has to approve agency bonds. When you go through this entire list, and there are only three agency bond projects on it because we're very mindful of our debt capacity. We're right now still at 5% or less of the total institutional budget is dedicated to debt service, which is, in my opinion, an amazingly low debt obligation in terms of the university's budget profile. So we've done a good job managing our debt, and so we are very cautious about putting agency bond funded projects on this list. Restricted funds can mean private money, could mean lots of things, and then federal speaks for itself. So most of these are state bonded request projects, this you could project an untold number of years into the future before we get around to some of these.
Does Bowling Green assess a stormwater fee to the university?
No, we are our own MSO. So we are like a small city.
In terms of sustainability, do you like random works and stuff like that?
We have done some samples, but it's very expensive. a lot of people ask us to do those type of projects, but we're currently working with Dr. Stevens. One of the items that we have introduced out of the new science building is about a $500,000 add to have one section of roof, one small section of roof. It increases the structural component of the building, and it just has ripple effects to the building so that we can have something going.
It makes more sense when you have a theme because you can offset the food.
And then going forward, all of our building projects will be LEED certified at one level or another in the LEED certification process. So that is a policy that this board approved several years ago.
And it's also a requirement of the state, anything over $5 million. So.
Any other questions or comments? I'll call the question. Approval of the first council.
Aye.
Aye. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed?
Now you're on, Brad.
Dr. Ansel, Regent Porter, members of the board. We recommend a motion to approve the purchase of the property located at 1840 Russell Road for $340,000 plus closing costs. You received two pages in your packet for pre-review, and I'll go over that property with you and get this to work. The property location is located on Russell Road, the entrance on the Russell Road, Morgantown Road side of campus. It is located between the Taco Bell and the Arby's is located here, and it's the property adjacent to the Arby's. There's a vacant lot here, and then the Waffle House is right at the corner. This property, if you proceed down Russell Road, the interest in this location in general is because Russell Road, obviously, we have a large number of commuter students coming in from the Hopkinsville Russell Road area west of campus. We also have, obviously, a large number of commuters coming off the Green River Parkway and entering campus from the old Morgantown Road area, and then also Morgantown Road hits Russell Road right at this section. So most of students commuting to campus from the Owensboro area locations south of that to WKU, they use these three general corridors on the campus. The property location, let me make a note of this too. The proposed Creason parking garage is right in this section here. And obviously, the two preferred locations we're sort of looking at in regard to parking garages are this Creason area and then this Adams Street area, which both, all three of those locations meet those corridors on the campus. The property. Here's a picture of what that property, proposed property, would look like with a parking lot located on that property. The property is 1.34 acres. It was the former site of the gas station, Brown and Shell Station. We did receive a letter from the current owner, no further action letter given to the owner by the Kentucky EPA, and that letter was dated 1999. So there's obviously, it's a gas station there. We were concerned about the environmental
impact. Is there environmental safety?
There was an environmental no further action letter from the Kentucky Department.
Was there any remediation done?
There was no remediation. Well, there was, yes, full tanks. Full the tanks, removed the soil, and then they did put some wells in to monitor that site, and they did that for a number of years, and then they were reasonably assured that the site was cleaned up, and obviously gave the owner a letter of number of questions. The survey indicated, obviously, we talked about a little bit, the student survey for this site, this Russell Road, Morgantown Road, is sort of the preferred location, or has been identified as a preferred location by our students. Roughly 45% or approximately 45% responded positively to parking locations down this Morgantown Road, Russell Road sort of corridor. So we're very comfortable that there's demand and need here that could be met with parking lot at this place location. Currently, the property is under contract contingent upon Board of Regents approval today for $340,000 plus closing costs. We did get an approved, state-approved letter from our, one of our state-approved appraisers. The appraisal on the property at February 15th of 2013 was $385,000. We asked him to confirm that that still was a good range in regard to the property, and he gave us a range of $350,000 to $385,000. So a $340,000 price for below any of those numbers that our state approved appraiser has for this property. Planning, design, and construction has proposed this. The good work has proposed this lot. This lot probably there's a little bit of grade back here, so a few of these spots probably will not be made available. This lot shows 150 spaces. We think probably somewhere between 125 and 150 spaces would be likely at this location. We also designed, or they also designed, the PVC bus pull-off, bus shuttle, covered shuttle location, and provided some opportunity for maybe some front drainage station. Possible uses would be construction swing space for the parking garage that we're going to build. Obviously, leaders, housing, satellite parking, athletic games, which would be a very good location for athletic games, overflow event parking, and obviously bus event parking. This is what we proposed this morning. Does anybody have any questions?
Well, sure. Since you have the no action letter, what use is that property doing?
They took the gas station
and
it's been vacant.
It's been for sale for how long?
The sale sign, for sale sign went up October.
It's been vacant for?
It's been vacant for 7 years. The property, there's been a little bit of activity in this area.
Larry, that also has had some storage, construction storage on it. It's been in use, but in some way, it's not just been taken all the time, but basically it's just fallen.
Jennifer Tugas is here, Director of Parking and Transportation Program. And Jennifer, share with the board how this will be financed.
We'll be using parking and transportation carry forward, as well as a little bit of our operations company here
to build out the property, to purchase the property, and then what's your concern? I move to the adoption of EX2, the initial response. Second. Motion is made and seconded. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries. We're going to take a short, about 10 minutes, working with the information item. Dr. Bob King, the president of the CPU, will be here. Glenn Betts, the chair of the committee. The information items under the executive committee. Section 4,
Thank you. Before we were with you a month ago in late March for the committee meetings and mentioned the spring enrollment, the spring 15, and that very day was Census Day, so we distributed with you then. Preliminary, I believe, Julie was floating around the final spring 2015 census enrollment report that we earned in, and you just said it for that, but in all honesty, much of that from the preliminary to the final enrollment report has not changed. We are at, for spring 2015, 18,560, down about 13 students in total enrollment. The report breaks down for you, and as I've mentioned in the March meetings, where we are categories, undergraduate, graduate, part-time, full-time, Freshman sophomore, junior, and you can follow as you go all the way down. I would repeat, as I did in the committee meetings, that more and more of our freshmen that are coming in with us are bringing in so many hours through dual credit, AP, flipping, otherwise, as this profile, this class has improved tremendously, our classes over the last recent years, that they're moving into sophomore status faster. That's where you see that difference in classification from freshman to sophomore, which is a positive thing. It means you're getting to graduation at a more rapid pace. You flip the document over. Again, as you imagine, for spring enrollment, transfers are driving the situation to show here. It breaks it down. We're transfer students in KCTCS, out of state, and another 4-year Kentucky's college. Again, this is a byproduct of our joint admissions with our KCTCS partners and then our two other institutions, one in Ball State and one in Ivy Tech, which were very successful in growing, actually finding and seeing the fruits of that those efforts. We will lay out the top majors. No, there should be no surprise to the board there, but nursing, health majors, all the way down to crossroad biology. You would just pick the top five for you, and then in-state, out-of-state, and all the top counties. We've added these in past years because the board was interested in how we broke out with our top counties and states that are feeding enrollment here at WKU, as well as the countries on the international enrollment, which international enrollment is some positive numbers of a little over 171 students for this go-around this spring. And I may have mentioned in the March meeting, just as highlighted points there, that the 4-year graduation rate has also increased. So that cohort that came in fall 2010 is a plus and positive to some of the many efforts that across campus, not just EEM, but everybody, faculty, staff, all helped make that happen. And our fall to spring retention rate, when we were in fall 2005 to current or present time, has moved from 84.7% up to 87%, which is very positive strides, and that didn't just happen overnight. That was a collective effort from across campus. It is a little early, again, but I would like to mention fall 15. Fall 15, we're into, they're approximately just shy of 30 ATPs. The ATPs were just enrolled in classes. We're right about 10 ATPs, up about 135 students in enrollment in that. But I'm cautiously optimistic on that based on applications and admits are all up for fall 15. But again, we still have 20 or so ATPs to go between now and the start of school in late August. So more information to come. We will be discussing at length with the board in the summer meetings, further fall enrollment, some changes to scholarship processes, and also just some recruitment initiatives we'll be sharing with you greater depth. That's sort of a snapshot of where we are this past spring. It's in the books now. Yielding efforts have moved to the fall. I believe the president mentioned the smart asset classification. That's one of dozens of yielding efforts, taking those admitted students and moving them to enrollment that went on. And we've sent those out to parents and students all in our prospect pool of students, and getting some really positive feedback. The message in that document was affordability, that WKU is affordable, and that is competitive across the board. So those are some of my initial thoughts here with enrollment today.
Just a couple observations. Very pleased with Brian's leadership and the work of Jace Lutz as he rose into his new duties as Director of Recruitment and Admissions. And you can sense a tide turning as we displace a lot of the part-time adult learners that we've lost over the last couple of years with full-time traditional students. Domestic and international. So I would point out the international variable to you, but the one, I'm going to mention one thing on here, mainly because Bob King asked me this question about 3 months ago when one of the other campuses was lamenting the fact that they were losing some Tennessee students because of a new Tennessee scholarship program that's gone into effect, where basically they provide free community college tuition for Tennessee students, I believe.
Yes.
Like the Tennessee number, we're down 48 from 1,364 to 1,316. So that tells me we're holding our own with our Tennessee enrollment population, in spite of some really serious incentives for students to stay in Tennessee go to the community college system. I gave you an anecdotal answer at the time, but here are the numbers, Bob, so there you go. So we're pleased with that we're continuing to be a university of choice in that 16-county TIP, Tuition Incentive Program region of Central Tennessee, that post-TIP dynamic is critical to maintaining a stable enrollment for us, given our proximity. I mean, Tennessee's half the distance to us that Oval would be, so it's an important recruitment area for us. So this fall numbers, and we'll begin reporting to you as the next fall, moving into the class of 2019 that will be enrolling in August. Any questions for Brian?
You mentioned summer school, it was a little early to mention summer school. I've talked about laws on that. We're monitoring that in May. But students usually wait until close to the end of spring semester to see what happens with spring parades, and you'll see enrollments drop. And we'll update you on summer school as well. We're pretty sure on that yet.
How's our enrollment figures compared to UK and U of L? Do they have a similar, just a bunch of loss of students? Is it larger, greater?
I can only give you again, without specific data, UK's enrollment is pretty strong. They're doing a lot of the same kinds of things we're doing. So their in-state full-time students is strong. U of L is probably a very similar set of data to ours. For everybody in America is recruiting national students. Almost everybody, at least those that understand the dynamic international marketplace. So I would say a lot of the situation is similar. Some campuses are one or two are up. UK is up. I think U of L is stable. We're stable. Some may be down a little bit. I don't CPE has the more precise numbers, but I wouldn't want to get into exact numbers. I wouldn't have accurate data. Yeah, we are leading all universities in Kentucky in transfer numbers. We are the leader in KCTCS transfers coming to WKU, and we've put a concerted effort in place in that regard. We've just established a transfer center as part of our undergraduate advising office. And that's an important dynamic. We have our joint admissions agreements with 7 KCTCS campuses plus Ivy Tech in Indiana and Volunteer State in Gallatin, Tennessee. We're just about to announce another one in Lexington with Bluegrass Community and Technical College with a joint admissions agreement. So those dynamics are beginning to pay off.
Any speculation on what's happening with the enrollment difference in the couple of counties in particular that are contiguous to or contiguous?
We have this past year we've augmented our efforts with those counties, Warren and all those touching Warren County here in the South Central Kentucky footprint. And so I believe you're going to see those turn around and be positive numbers as we get into 15 and spring 16 as well. Many of the students that they're taking some class with us, they're taking going through joint admissions, it's just a variety. I don't know that there's a consistent theme there from those particular counties. They're also phenomenal, they're swirling a little bit. They may be enrolled with us and some of the KCTCS sponsors. So it's a combination of factors there. And we have tenfold ratcheted up our efforts here and just our immediate footprint to make sure we're just really regular with them.
Again, Barbara, I don't have precise data, but my take on that is that reflects the adult learner dynamics, especially the geographic logic would suggest that we have more part-time adult learners the closer to the campus you get, and as we lost those populations, not completely lost them, but as we lost a significant portion of those populations, that is going to affect Warren County members more than anyone else. I don't think we're seeing those declines at the high school level. In fact, we're Roth is strong in our five local hospitals that in Barron County is third largest producer of students for us. So this, as you well know, this whole enrollment management, part art and part science, but it's more art. And you just have to understand the dynamics and marketplace. It's a core part.
Thank you, Mark.
Any questions for Brian? I want to report that the board has completed its evaluation, President's annual evaluation, and the final report was distributed with your information this morning. And President Mansell and I have gone through that together, and appreciate all that you're doing for the university. And everything is thank you for your continued efforts and leadership. And any questions that you can check with us later and address it.
I appreciate the board's support and endorsement. It was a strong evaluation and quite an incentive to keep the energy and the focus and the drive going that both Julie and I are most fortunate to be able to continue to do what we do and watch the impact. A lot of things we've talked about this morning, the results speak for themselves. So thank you very much for a good evaluation, and we're all in.
Are you going to parachute again at least once a year? That's a requirement, I think.
No, the answer to that would be no. But now, the Golden Knights come back every year, and, you know, maybe. But I'm not coming down without those guys.
I think it might be appropriate to say that, you know, Lesky's had a lot of successes that are directly related to the energy, enthusiasm that our president brings every day to his job. And in particular, the latest initiative, I think, that involves both Caribbean and Iceland. I'm expecting him to move to Gulf Springs or something. If possible, he could do it, but really, I think that's a great example of Western differentiating itself, and it's all of us around the state. We are the best value in higher education in our time zone.
Thank you, Philip. I was going to get a message out to the board, but I'll just do it verbally. I do leave for Belize tomorrow, and I'll be back on Wednesday, and we do sign an agreement on Monday morning with the Caribbean Community Climate Change Center, which is a consortium of the heads of state of all 28 Caribbean nations. Same kind of agreement, similar to what we signed in Iceland 5 or 6 weeks ago. And the intent, and both the Caribbean nations and Iceland are most enthusiastic and anxious to connect because, as Philip suggested, they are connected by the Gulf Stream, and it does dictate the climate to both the Caribbean nations and in Iceland, and they're both dealing with the effects of climate change and the melting polar ice cap. So that's going to be a fascinating agreement that we'll sign, and we'll be meeting with most of the heads of state of the Caribbean nations on Monday and Tuesday. And so we're going to try to get as many of them here on our campus to come together for a climate change summit sometime this coming year. So fascinating things led by faculty in our Department of Geography and Geology. Incredible work. Very innovative work with all the geopolitical dynamics as well as the environmental implications.
Yeah, again, I think the word translational comes forward with that. It's an opportunity for research in a very important arena regarding climate change is going to be available to Western faculty and students. It could be very, very important work for our planet.
When our students engage. Thank you.
You want
welcome Dr. Bob King, who's president of CPE. Most of you have heard him speak or been to meetings.
Can you see the nominating committee? I want that cursor, please.
Okay. I'm sorry. Larry, I understand that you had preliminary, you had Dr. Capps' knowledge, so that's why you can articulate the second motion.
You taught me many things.
I appointed Melissa Benison and Cynthia Harris as a committee with me to discuss nominations for board positions, for chairs and the executive committee members, and we'll be convening and reporting to you during the summer meetings in the future. So, hope everyone will keep that in mind. And if you have any comments that you want to direct us, contact any of us, email us, I'll consider the comments as we back to you before the meeting is presented. Bob, we're glad to have you today, and appreciate you coming to discuss the higher education funding model process that's being reviewed, and welcome you to Western.
You're not allowed to tie.
I'm working for you.
Good choice.
I'm working for you.
You know, many of you may not know that David at one time served on the Commission on Higher Education, I think it was the nomination, Council on Higher Education, that was a predecessor to the Council on Post-Secondary Education, which changed as part of House Bill 1 and the 1998 legislation changing by Paul Patton. Bob has been president of the council for
6 years.
That's a great background in not only elected positions in New York, but work with the system of institutions in New York, public institutions in New York, which is a system of great institutions. So, Bob, welcome to WKU. I know you've been here many times, but this is part of the first time I think you've addressed our board at a Board of Regents meeting. And you'll introduce your board chair, I expect, in route.
I will. Well, first, thank you so much for inviting me and this handsome guy over here, Glenn Denton. He's been on the CPG since I've been here, but was just recently elected by his colleagues to serve as chair. He's over in Paducah, and it's a whole lot easier for him to get to Bowling Green than to get to Frankfurt, so I'm delighted to have Glenn here. This really is an opportunity that we don't get very often to meet with our campus board's regions. So I'm grateful for the invitation and for your willingness to give us some time. Just kind of one pitch to you. What we have seen in our role at the council is, among other things, we serve as kind of the overseer on behalf of the consuming public. Of both the institutions and the private and independent colleges, and then the proprietary colleges if they offer at least a bachelor's degree. And over the last several years, from time to time, we encounter campuses experiencing very serious problems, typically financial, but not always. And in every instance, as we have been drawn into these issues and tried to help figure out what to do on behalf of the students who are attending these issues, it becomes increasingly clear that in one way or another, boards of regents or boards of trustees of those institutions went to sleep at the switch. And so the role that we play, and as good a president as we've got, he is a superstar, let's say, and without being able to be But the role that you play as fiduciaries, representing the people of the state of Kentucky, and in a very real sense, the students who attend, is vitally important. And it's important to have that good working relationship with your chief executive. It's also important to make sure that you hold his feet to the fire. Who set goals, as the campus is pursuing those goals, that all of the pieces come together, whether it's enrollment or academics or finance or athletics, which is always a very risky spot as we see across the country in higher education. Make sure that all of those pieces, and probably several more that I haven't mentioned, are working effectively. It's really your responsibility. And so, I'm honored to be here, but thrilled by the fact that you don't need your time, and I suspect your financial resources to support this institution. But what we need most is your judgment. And it helps Gary be a better president, and it helps this university continue to grow and grow. So, thank you. With that, Gary asked me to come and talk to you about this effort that has been underway at the council now for well over a year. And what stimulated the effort was this reality. The state funds that come to us in whatever volume of dollars, whether it's a lot, has been a lot, but whatever it's been, or less, currently is distributed to the campuses largely on the basis of no rational factor other than kind of an artifact of historic spending that at one time or another may have been tied to some formula that has long since been abandoned, to old relationships in terms of not necessarily between the campuses, but relative relationships in terms of enrollment. Over time, where we are today is the money is distributed to the campuses based on the percentage of the whole that they got last time. And that's been going on now for a number of budget cycles. If you went back to 1997, when House Bill 1 was adopted, Governor Patton's higher education reform, there was a companion bill. It was a pot of money. And what that money did is it was distributed disproportionately to campuses to get everybody up to a point where they felt, relative to each other and on whatever basis, that they were being treated fairly. Well, over the intervening 18 or 19 years, stuff has changed. Campuses have grown at different rates. They've taken on different programs. They have different cost structures. Their missions have been modified either by actions of the legislature or by the demands within their region. And yet the funding bears no relationship to any of those factors. It's just whatever percentage of the whole we got last year is the percentage of the whole we should get next year. We call it shares. And everybody looks when the money gets distributed that they got their share. What the council said to us in the face of some very articulate expressions of concern about this is let's take a look at a different way of doing this. And the first paragraph there really pertains to language in House Bill 1 from 1997. And the second paragraph is what we were directed to do, which was to attempt to create a comprehensive model for the allocation of state general fund appropriations for institutional operations that incorporates elements of campus performance, of mission, and enrollment, as well as any other components as determined by the process. And so in the intervening year plus, we have had two groups working in parallel. One group is all of the presidents plus several of the council members, which is our steering group. And the other group are the working professionals, including campus business officers, provosts, people from our staff. And I should mention, by the way, on the steering group, we had the budget director, the state budget director, and and somebody from First Staff working along with that group. And what we said to the group is, could we come up with a model? Forget the numbers right now. But what would be the reasonable factors that could be considered and should be considered to have a more rational distribution of funds tied to these criteria? So that's what we undertook to do. Ultimately, what we are looking at in writ large is, and these are the factors that went into this model, performance, and I'll tell you what the elements of that constitute. The mission, whether you're a research campus, whether you're a comprehensive, within that role, you have certain mandated obligations by statute, enrollment, because campuses have grown at different rates. We use the word here parity, but you can call it equity. It's this notion that the campuses believe that they are getting their fair share of state funds, the funds coming from the general fund. And then finally, are the funds that we're getting collectively adequate to meet our needs? And so those are the principal driving factors that drove these discussions. This is a very crude effort to try and describe three approaches that have emerged through these discussions. The first, which is way over on the left, does the following. It takes the general fund appropriations to each campus, divides that by the full-time equivalent enrollment, so you get a number, which is the number of dollars that come to the campus per full-time equivalent student. Very simple. At the other end of the spectrum is a very similar approach, but the starting point is different. In this approach, on the far right, you take the total of the general fund appropriation and add to that tuition, and then divide it by the full-time equivalent enrollment, and you get a number. It's both approaches, the far left and the far right, are very simple. But they I'll show you in a minute, they produce very different results. What the steering committee did, and what this effort did, is we said either of those approaches was too simple, because it doesn't take into account mission and cost of instruction and the balances of in-state versus out-of-state students and performance, all the things the council told us to do. And so the steering committee has come up with a much more comprehensive model, and I'll share some more about that with you in the next couple of slides. But this is really right now, because there is no agreement. But the left side and the right side circles are kind of the span of the disagreement. And the proposal that the steering committee put together really represents a pretty good compromise. And in fact, the numbers, as they play out, fall almost dead in the middle between the two proposals. So let me show you what I mean by this. This column right here shows you the relative positions of the campuses compared to the median of the distribution of state funds. So what those numbers mean is that Eastern is right at the median, at about 100%, that Moorhead's funding is above the median, 104.3, Murray's 105, Northern is only 72%, 73% of the median, and Western is only 84% of the median. If you come over to this column, you can see, using the tuition plus general fund, that
while Murray is a bit of an outlier at 113% of the median, all the other campuses are within about 2% of each other. So the spread here is much narrower. But the CPE model, the steering committee model, shows that there is a disparity, and it ranges from 83% of the median in that calculation for Northern, 94% Western, and then Eastern is a little bit above, Murray a little bit more above, and Moorhead more significantly above the median. I'm not talking about dollars here. I'm just talking about relative funding for each campus based on the model. So here's what the steering committee looked at and considered to derive the model that we think makes a great deal of sense and is responding to what the council directed us to do. First, we used the notion of credit hours earned, and credit hours become a proxy for enrollment. So the more students you have, the more credit hours you will be delivering. But the key here is not credit hours taken, it's credit hours earned. And these are weighted by course levels, cost of instruction, and discipline. So, for example, if you're a campus that may happen to have a newly approved engineering program, congratulations, you will have cost for that program recognized in this. Not just that there's one student there, but that the cost of educating that student relative to a student either elsewhere on your campus or on another campus who, let's say, is an English major, would be reflected in the model. You get the point. There is differentiated weighting for in-state versus out-of-state students. We have some campuses that argue that out-of-state students shouldn't count at all, that state taxpayers should not be subsidizing for those students. So no general fund money should be allocated for that purpose. We have others that say, no. Bringing in out-of-state students is a great benefit to the state. It produces economic benefit because they come here and spend money on our dormitories and in our country. And about 35 or 40% of them stay in Kentucky and add to the Kentucky economy. So we had to kind of work that out and came to a compromise, but that's part of the equation. We looked at maintenance and operating costs because every campus has these things called buildings. And some buildings are older, some buildings are more complicated, and so the formula takes into account, there's a set of numbers that we use to kind of balance these expenses out by campus across the span of the comprehensive. And then on the performance side, we looked at the number of degrees produced at each campus, and we weighted those degrees by the relative dollar value that those degrees generate for our graduates in the Kentucky marketplace, with a premium placed on kids the campuses who produce STEM plus health degrees, that's science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, degrees attained by underrepresented minority students, or low-income students. And so just to give you an example, if, let's say, an English degree from Western is worth 1.6. If it was earned by a low-income student who is African-American, that would actually have a value in the model of, there's, I think, 3/10 of a point for each of those factors. So that degree would be worth 2.2. In any event, those are the key factors. And then finally, we looked at, as a starting point, the actual spending that our campuses are doing relative to each other on student services, on the allocated overhead per student, and instruction. So these are the factors that were incorporated and then weighted by different weightings, and a lot of that was the expression of compromise among the campuses and their various views, to come up with the model that, as I told you, leads to this middle set of comparisons. Now, the significance of this, ultimately, is what would happen in the budget and in a budget request. And so, if you were to adopt this model where the spread, leave aside Murray, which is above the spread, okay, but everybody else is within 2 points of each other, the presidents who are arguing for that model are saying, well, there really isn't any equity problem. If you're with the presidents on this side, because these guys are 30 points, 17, 18 points below these other guys, they're saying there's a big spread. And this model says the disparity isn't as great as these guys say, but we think that there is an equity issue that needs to be addressed. And that would benefit these two camps.
Bob may be getting to this, but can you just touch on why there, what prompted the equity disparity, the lack of parity? What caused that over the last 10 or 15 years?
I think what's happened is that campuses have grown at different rates. The other thing that's happened, by the way, is campuses have taken on different programs, but also tuition rates, which used to be common across the comprehensives, now are quite differentiated. And so, Gary, you've been here far longer than I have. Are there other...
Well, no. In fact, I'm going to give the board a line chart that shows our tuition. Going back to 1979-80, I'll get copies of this and give it to you because I think it's pertinent to the discussion. But the funding was doing pretty good coming out of House Bill 1 in 1998, and we rocked along for 4 or 5 or 6 years with pretty decent funding and not a lot of cuts, and the campuses that were growing were. But along about 2004, 5, or 6, the problems began to unfold. And since 2008, we've had nothing but cuts. And the institutions that have grown have watched their state funding per student drop dramatically. For example, in really round numbers, our state appropriations per student has dropped from about $7,200 to about $4,500 per student as we grew very dramatically between 2002 and 2008. And so state funding has not been able to keep pace with enrollment growth. Campuses that did not grow as dramatically, therefore, were able to sustain a level of state funding, and it's created a parity, a concern from a funding perspective. And in order to compensate, and this is what I'll pass around to you, in order to compensate for the declining in funding per student, this board took some pretty dramatic action in the middle of that dynamic. We had 3 years of a mid-year tuition increase. That was at a time when the campuses had the autonomy to control their own tuition, understand the marketplace, and work within your marketplace to set your price point accordingly. And so we raised our tuition pretty dramatically. And the analogy there is that our students have been asked to pay the difference in what the state has been unable to pay as we grew. And that's what we're trying to advocate in this model to help address that. We've got no issue with the other campuses bringing their price point up to ours. But we would like for the state appropriation to be similar as well. Is that a fair?
It is fair. Let me use this as an example. The reason that these numbers are as close to each other, 900, 98, 102, is because this column includes tuition. So what you have, and this is our concern, is the campuses that are getting higher amounts of state support, general fund support per student, are able to charge lower tuition. The campuses that are getting less support per student are having to charge higher tuition because, in fact, they're all spending about the same. It's just the source of the revenue, right? Now, part of the challenge here has been, and Gary just said, is when you grow your enrollment quickly and there's not corresponding funding from the state, even if the funding was exactly the same as it was 10 years ago or 5 years ago, by growing the enrollment, you're diluting the utility of those dollars. So that's, those are choices that you make. And I think all of us are, first, there was a great deal of pressure on the campuses coming from the General Assembly and from the Council to grow enrollment. We wanted more people to go to college. The problem was the funding didn't keep up with it. And so you had to make some very tough choices, whether you were going to do it on essentially tuition alone, because that's what you essentially had to do. So, anyways, let me just click through this. So here's what we're thinking about right now in terms of a budget request. Now, the sequence of events here is my chairman just appointed at our meeting last week the Budget Development Committee of the Council. We will begin that process post-haste, and we'll have to have a budget proposal delivered to the governor's office in early November. Now, this year is a little bit unusual because it's a gubernatorial election. We don't know who's going to win, but we will submit a budget proposal to Governor Beshear. He will receive it, but then once the election's over, whoever the new governor is will have a transition team. That team will include people who develop the budget. Obviously, what we submit will be a starting point for them. So here's what we've been thinking about. The first is that we would, if we can get the president to agree on an approach, we don't have that agreement yet, but to the extent that, model that the steering committee kind of shepherded through is literally in the middle of the two kind of competing approaches. That would define whether or not there's this parity issue. We think that they're as big as the far left version of things, and it's not as small as the far right version of things. But what we would do is we would look at the amount of money it would take to get everybody up to at least 100% of the formula. And I think we're actually targeting 103%, because that would get, I think, three or four of the campuses kind of at about the same level. Once we created that amount of money, if we got it, that would then establish new shares, right? Now, what we think is, by the way, just as a quick asterisk, we wouldn't go through this process every budget cycle. That we think if we could come to an agreement and establish these new shares, that you wouldn't have to come back and revisit this whole thing every 2 years or every 4 years, maybe even every 6 years. Because things don't change that dramatically. Over 18 years, they did. And so what we think we would do is establish new shares and then calculate whatever additional funding we would want that would then be distributed to everybody in proportion to the new shares and tied to performance criteria that I'm going to talk to you about in just a minute. And this would be performance criteria that could be identical to what's in the model, or it could be other criteria, and I'll show you what I mean by that in a second. And what we're thinking about right now is what we have tried to do, at least during my time here, is make budget recommendations to the governor and the General Assembly that are reasonable. Asking them for pie-in-the-sky stuff, you just kind of get laughed out of the room. And we know right now that the General Assembly and the next governor are going to have to deal with the pension problem. They're going to have to deal with a growing Medicaid budget because of the Obamacare adoption. And so the likelihood that in the absence of new revenue called raised taxes or an improving, significantly improving economy, and the economy is improving in Kentucky, which is good to see. Whether it's improving enough, we don't know yet. But regardless, what we feel strongly about is making a request to the General Assembly that, at least as I say, isn't laughed out of the room. Whether they're funded or not is another question. So what we're thinking about is a request that's somewhere in the range of $90 to $100 million. That would recover about half of what we've lost in the general fund appropriations since 2008. We've lost about $175 million. And we'd like to try and recover close to half of that. So that's the sizing that we're thinking about. So, performance funding models. Let me explain what we mean by this. There's kind of two big approaches to this. One is that you create a pot of money, you set criteria that the campuses have to meet, and as much of the criteria as they generate, they would then get that proportion of the money. So if we said degrees produced improvement in graduation rates by a certain increment, just use those two. And we measure everybody. And it turns out that Western has, of the total pot of everybody's degrees produced and graduation rate improvement, has generated 10% of the total improvement. They would get 10% of the money. That's one approach. And in that approach, every campus is competing against every other campus. Whoever gets the most of the business. It's kind of the approach that represents. There are two discussions about what would happen to the money. One is that whatever money you earn becomes recurring. So it goes into your base and it becomes your starting point for the next budget cycle. Senator Gibbons, in this last session, a few weeks ago, introduced a resolution that passed the Senate. It didn't get taken up in the House, that would say, no, we'll create a pot of money that you all compete for, and whatever you earn, you get that year or following the point you earn it, but then it doesn't go into your base budget. It comes back and creates a pot for the next cycle, which is something that we're not enthusiastic about, but it is an approach. The second larger approach is that once we establish the shares, let's say Western share of, once we do the parity, is 8 or 9% of the whole, somewhere close to 11%. Right? We'll call it 10% just to make it. So if the legislature puts out a pot of $25 million, Western would be able to earn its share of the $25 million. However, we would set performance criteria, and let's say we set that you had to increase degrees produced by 100 degrees, but you only produced 50 more degrees. So you got halfway to the target. So what you would earn would be half of your target. And therefore, instead of getting 10%, you'd get 5%. And you'd get half of whatever your share was. Follow me? And then again, the argument would have become recurring or non-recurring. That's just another approach. But in this approach, the campuses don't compete against each other. They compete against themselves and against the targets that we would set and that you would help set for improvement on whatever the metrics are that we use. And then finally, these are the kinds of things that we're talking about regarding the metrics. And the metrics are the things that are important to us. Number one, degrees produced. Number two, improving graduation rates. Improving retention rates. And you know, by the way, that if we set targets for graduation rates today, it's going to be 4 or 5 or 6 years before we see significant movement But retention gives you a lot earlier information about how we're doing, because if you improve your retention rates, the data shows us, and experience tells us, that that helps increase graduation rates a few years later. Achievement gaps. This is probably our single biggest challenge. Is at every campus, it is the case that while we are admitting more minority students, more low-income students, the problem is that they are not graduating at the same rate as students coming from non-minority families or from middle and upper families. This is the country's challenge. And it's obviously something that we want to encourage, and so using this as one of the metrics would be a way to incentivize the campuses to redouble their efforts to improve those numbers. Research productivity. This may or may not be something that the financial institutions would want to participate in part because there is no definition of what those words mean. Historically, when we've measured research, it's usually been a dollar value of externally funded research. If you got lots of grants, everybody went for rock. But what we're saying is the research translating into something that's having an impact on the state of Kentucky or on the world? And so we're working with at least the research campuses to come up with a better definition of what that might be. Degrees per 100 full-time equivalent students is a way that's kind of an emerging vehicle for efficiency and how successful we are at getting our students out the door with a degree. And then finally, putting some premium on the types of degrees. STEM plus H tend to be the most valuable in the marketplace. And then, just to close this out, in the upcoming biennium for the research sector, when we applied the model to them, to Louisville and Kentucky, there was no parity issue. They're funded at about what the model says, and so any money we would ask for would be tied to performance, however we define performance. KCTCS is its own system. So for the comprehensives, if our model is utilized or something like it, some of the money we would ask for would go to this parity issue, and then the balance that we would ask for the comprehensive sector would be tied to performance. And then in the next biennium, it says we have the parity issue resolved, we hope, then all of the money that we would ask for could be tied to performance. So I hope, this is complicated stuff, but I tried to, you know, for beginners who aren't dealing with this stuff every day, like we've been living it for the last year and a half, I tried to just give you an overview that I hope is understandable, but I'm happy to take questions if you have time or comments or questions. Any questions?
Judge, how come UK and U of L have parity already and your university don't?
Again, using the model, I don't want to say that the elements of the model are arbitrary, but it was what collectively the presidents and the CEOs and the provosts didn't agree on every piece of it, but we got as close as we could get to agreement and applied it to them, and their funding relative to each other was about where the model says it should be.
Right, they, my take on that is their growth and their increases in state funding have somewhat paralleled each other. UK and U of L have a higher tuition than us. We've got the highest tuition rate among the comprehensive institutions. So UK has grown more than U of L, and their state funding has grown probably.
Or shrunk. I mean, it's
their tuition and their growth have had a bit more balance, where we've grown more dramatically at a time when the state couldn't fund it. When all this started, they were getting a higher percentage of state funding, and they, because as Bob said, our model is what we had last time, the same ratios hold true this time, and so their positioning has stayed about the same, and they haven't grown as much as we have,
and their state funding has been relatively constant when state funding has been available.
Also, though, remember that this model and the numbers are only the relative position of the campuses to each other. It says nothing to do with whether the amount of money was adequate. Okay? It's just the relative relationships. So with the two research universities, they have grown at about the same pace. They have moved their tuition at about the same pace. They have been cut at comparable rates. So relative to each other, they just haven't seen the large swings that we have seen in the comprehensive sector. Okay? If you went back to 1997, 98, 2000, wherever Moorhead was and wherever Western was, what's happened is Western's grown a lot and Moorhead shrunk a little bit and is now slowly coming back. So just in enrollment growth, even if there was relative parity in funding back then, the enrollment growth was really driven to the disparity.
In one sense, if you look at our strategic plan and our vision and what we've been about for the last 18 years, you probably wouldn't find much value in grouping institutions in a research sector and a comprehensive sector, because we feel like we're probably as an institution more like European U of L than the other comprehensive institutions. But for purposes of this funding model, it does work because it does address the parity dynamic, which is critical to us. So for those reasons, we support this funding model.
I was going to ask a question. Judging performance is obviously difficult. They're at the high school level and using ACT exam scores, for instance, which our student population scores have been steadily going up, so we're attracting a better quality student. But when you get to the college level and you hear about grade inflation and academic rigor varying, is there any national testing method that you all have talked about or looked at that you're going to utilize to judge performance in some manner?
Well, you hit on a terrific question. I'm glad you asked it. One of the things that we've struggled with at the council when we developed our last strategic plan, we're dealing with it again now, is this question. You're really talking about academic quality, right? There is an effort that's underway right now that's being managed through the National Association of People Who Do the Work That I Do. It's called SHEO. It's the State Higher Education Executive Officers Association. I'm serving as the chair of it this year. And there's an effort that's been underway now for about 2.5 years in which 8 states are participating. We are one of the 8 to try and come up with a common method of assessing academic quality. And doing so, looking exclusively at the quality of student performance at various points in their career. What we'd like to try and come up with is a mechanism that really serves as this assessment process, largely to help faculty improve their teaching. But it would also give us a sense of how our programs are actually working in real terms. At the moment, we have 3 institutions that are participating in the effort. UK, Murray has just joined, and Hazard Community and Technical College. And they're part of this larger effort, and the other 7 states have 3, 4, 5, some may have as many as 6 institutions working together to try and come up with a common methodology that has integrity and that can give us credible answers that could be looked at kind of in comparison from institution to institution or state to state. Still a bit away from being completed, but what we're hoping is that once it is completed, that we could include that metric
in whatever model we come up with. And it would be great if we could get Western it's not terribly costly, but it does take some time and faculty time that have to be devoted to come up with today. But we think it's been worth the effort. It's spearheaded by my counterpart from the state of Massachusetts, who's done a lot of work in this area. But it is something we're looking at. The other thing, by the way, is, and you may be doing this already, but I've found it's very helpful to, number one, survey employers who hire your graduates and find out what they think. And then also to survey your alumni about 5 years out from graduation. And the question I always want to know is, does your education prepare you adequately for whatever it is you're doing? And those surveys help as well.
The model that you described really is equitable, increases in state. On the other hand, when you look at where the administration state has been, it's been more about reduction. And so my question is, and those reductions have been proportional, and they've exacerbated problems. So the question is, could this model be used in future reduction distribution decisions?
The answer is yes, it could. What we have talked about among the presidents and essentially came to this agreement, is that as a starting point, if the budget for higher education is either flat or is declining, if we were to apply the model, the only way you could move money around is to take money away, which we have fundamentally agreed we're not going to do that. Well, once the new shares are established and we get to this equity thing, then, yeah, it would be applied regardless of what happens, assuming we could get the equity piece undertaken. The one observation I would make is if the share that you currently have, and it is, in our view, the case that Western's share is below what it should be, so when the cuts came, the share of the cuts you got was below what you would have gotten if we had the larger share. So in one sense, Western has been protected by the disparity in the cut level. But
protected may be a stretch.
Right? If you should have a 9% share and you've only had a 7% share, then you only got 7% of the cut instead of 9%.
You would rather give this presentation here than at Murray, I assume.
No, I'd be happy to give it anywhere. I think it's important that, you know, as this moves forward and whatever we end up agreeing to, that the boards need to know and understand what the thinking is behind it. Yeah.
Just to applaud your efforts, I know by talk around the dining table how hard this is. My wife served on Bob's committee, post-secondary education, until recently, but the new shares, once it's established, is a little concerning from this standpoint. Is that the new money, or is that reappropriating all the funds that are coming?
Well, it's not going to reappropriate all the funds, but the model is currently based on the current distribution. So eventually it will encompass the whole distribution. What we're saying is to get to equity or parity, it's going to take new money to do it. And what we're saying is, and I'll use real numbers here for a second. If we think it would take $18 million to get Western and Northern up to 100% of the former, okay? And we say that it's going to take $18 million. And let's say we're going to ask for $12 million additional dollars that would be distributed to everybody based on the new shares or based on performance. Right? So that's $30 million for the comprehensive assessment. If we get the full $30 million, then Western and Northern would get 18 plus
the share of the 12, and the other campuses would only get the increments of the 12. One of the issues we've had is 18 to 12, I think, is 60 to 40, right? If we get less than 30 million, let's say we only get 15 million, would you take the full 15 and distribute that to the campuses that are below, or would you distribute that 60-40? You'd probably do it 60-40, because we've got to deal with it. And we want, we looked at five or six other states to develop various types of models. And the one that we thought was the most attractive, and reluctant to say this, was actually the state of Mississippi. When they adopted their model, they realized that just politically, if there wasn't some money for all the campuses, you know, it was going to fail in the legislature. So that's what we were trying.
And the last point there was the new shares, once they're established. Yeah, I heard you mention in the presentation that there had not been a determination of how frequently that would be revisited. My only suggestion would be is to use an odd number rolling average, since we're on a biennium,
right,
and also we're focused on a four-year education, so to speak, that if you did a 3 to 5 year rolling average with percentages of triggers, if it veers off that the average, then you would immediately review the entire funding share.
Well, that's a really good point. And if the model, if we can actually get agreement on the model, and you could use that to monitor that disparity. Now, the other thing, by the way, is if future new funding is tied to performance, then that'll start changing the shares anyway, right? And so then you could use the model to say if we get too far out of whack. Okay? But part of the notion of performance funding is to say you want the money, you got to perform. So.
Tom, to think a specific answer to your question is we wrestled with the thought of redistributing the current base funding dynamic. And while WKU and NKU were in favor of that, we weren't going to win that wrestling match. And so I acquiesced, and Jeff Mearns is now about to come around at NKU, because Jeff is now supporting the model. And so we basically agreed to not redistribute the base. That's just a battle that we weren't going to get consensus on. And the importance of consensus, if not unanimity, is when we go to the General Assembly, what I'm hoping is that we all arrive at a number, and Bob used a $90 million number, because that was about half of the money we've lost since 2008, $175 million to cut since 2000 for all of higher ed. So we try to get half of that back, one million, half another million. Some campuses may want to go for their whole 173 and use that as your rationale. Just fund us at 2008 levels. But that's yet to be determined. But the objective is to get all the campuses fighting for that number and not worried about the model. We'll take care of the distribution through a CPE funding formula, but CPE and the campuses and everybody is there advocating for the number that we're seeking for these reasons. But in order to get to that point, you need all eight institutions and KCTCS to agree to the model, so that there's not the infighting and the backdoor politicking to, well, we didn't agree with the model, so just worry about us. Everybody's out for themselves. And we're pretty close. By dividing into the sectors has helped depoliticize the process, because UK and U of L aren't worried about what the others might be getting or not getting, and we're not worried about, because they've got their share of the current base. And nobody's going to encroach on the other sector's current base amount. So that's why the sectors help. Right now, there's an institution or two that is not ready to buy into the model, but we're close. And sooner or later, probably CPE is going to have to step in and put a time clock in play and hire
I've tried that several times. Everybody knows me now until October and November. So.
But at any rate, but that's politically, it's important that we all go arm in arm with one message: fund the number. And otherwise, you could have the General Assembly stepping in and saying, "Well, we got a model. We're just going to do our model. If y'all can't get along or y'all can't agree." So that's the political dynamic is that we're about to get into the political dynamic, but we got to complete the pragmatic dynamic of the distribution of whatever that number is.
You know, I should add that it sounds like Carolyn was responsible for this, but we are in the process right now of building a political campaign to get some restoration of funding for higher education. And it starts with our students and their parents. But I want to say to you, every one of you serve on this board because the governor recognized you for something you've done. And you are viewed in his eyes, and I suspect others, as leaders in your communities, in your organizations, on the faculty, and in the student government. But we're going to need everybody to visit legislators in their district offices during the fall, not when we get into session. And we're in the process right now of, we've got an RFP that I think is going out today to secure the services for the survey research front so that we can understand what the public thinks, what they like, what they don't like, help us craft the right message and the right rhetoric. We've got lots of data and we can put this into talking points. We met with our student government leaders the other day, and for me, I have to tell you, I don't get to deal with students very often, so when I have these moments, it's just a joy. But as we're kind of talking about kind of the politics of this and how to organize a campaign, these kids are coming up with more ideas than they'll ever come up with in terms of groups they can organize and how to do stuff on their campuses and how to use social media and all this stuff. It is something that we need to do, and we need to work together, not just Gary and Robin. I was with some legislators recently. I was on a panel in Eastern, and faculty members were in attendance, and they asked one of the legislators, well, what can we do? And it said to them, I said to the faculty member, you need to come and visit us in our district offices. Not come to the Capitol once a year and stand in the rotunda and scream for more money. And he said, and the presidents and the government liaison people, when they come, we know what they want. We want to hear from you. Okay. And I've served in the legislature, and I can tell you, legislators aren't good at much, but they are good at counting. And they count signatures on petitions and people who come to visit them. And now the tweets and all that stuff matters. They think, because the only people that come to see this are, you know, the 25 people that are the presidents, the government liaison people, and the CPE, that that's all the people that care about higher education. So we've got to put a full court press on it. And we'll be doing more when we get into the fall. But we're going to need your help. And obviously, we've been doing important candidates. Whoever's going to be the next governor is going to come into a very tough fiscal situation. But higher ed has just been easy out. By the way, in addition to cutting us, which they've been doing consistently, if you didn't hear this, you know the lottery? The law that created the lottery said that other than $3 million, that goes to a literacy program, all the rest of it is to be for student financial aid. Right? So in the last budget session, last year, the legislature took $70 million out of the lottery to be used for general purpose government. Right? $70 million would have served about 20,000 additional students who qualified for financial aid and couldn't get it. What that does is it either means they don't go, they borrow, or it puts more burden on the campuses
to come up with more campus-based financial aid to help these kids meet whatever their financial obligations. So we really need your help.
I really appreciate that last illustration because I think that's something we generally don't know, and it kind of segues into something we want to ask you. I know you put up a hypothetical performance model and it got some detail, isn't it? But on these seven indicators that you did, degrees, retention, pleasures, and so on, many of those are ones that the institution has some measure of control over in terms of efficiency. The one you said was the greatest problem was closing achievement gap, and that goes back to the underrepresented low income, which goes back to affordability, which comes all the way back again to tuition. If a campus were really not committed to making Kentucky stronger and serving all students, the easier thing to do is to work really hard in all those other categories and not have as many students that are going to be high risk, which is exactly the opposite of what you want. How's the model going to address that to enable campuses to know that you're risking your performance on these other indicators because you're taking students that present better tests? That's what we ought to do.
Well, there's a couple ways. One is in the funding model that we created, there are performance elements in there. And as you saw, the degrees earned get additional weighting if they're earned by a low income student. So there's a premium, which is one instance. Another would be, let's say, for example, that for the campuses, you select four of those metrics. They don't all have to be weighted the same in the model. So we could choose to say closing achievement gaps is so important, we're going to weight that 50%, and we're going to weight each of the other three, in increments of the remaining 50%. That'd be another idea. The other thing, I think, though, is what we've done since I've been here is, we've got our strategic plan, and we have there 10 metrics. And every year, I make every president come before the council in a public session and describe how their campus is doing on those metrics. Now, what we've learned is some of the metrics we adopted probably aren't telling us as much as we want, so we're going to change them. And we're working with the campuses to come up with even better metrics than the ones we've had. But I do think that notion of coming into a public session and describing to the council, and our council members are as well prepared for these things and as committed as all of you are. They just look at it writ large instead of an individual campus. But they, from time to time, will interrupt the president or a provost, whoever's making the presentation, and say, how come this number isn't good enough? What are you doing with it? Our staff every year, as you know, Student Success Summit and a number of other events during the year, working directly with faculty, with administrators, with our provost, to find the very best practices we can in the country. We bring high quality speakers in to share with everybody the strategies that are working most effectively. Now, something that works at campus A may not work at campus B, but they should learn it and modify what may or may not work. What we're seeing is the campuses that are adopting these practices that we're bringing in are starting to see results. And that has an impact. So when Gary comes in and says, here's what we were able to do at our campus, and we were able to improve these sets of outcomes for the students, the other campuses are sitting there, and we're sitting there, and saying to the other campuses, maybe I'll go talk to Gary. This is, to me, the single biggest challenge in higher education. Is you know the demographics of the country are changing, that our institutions have got to get better at serving populations of people who are coming without necessarily a family history or a parental history of ever having gone to college. They are just maybe on the borderline of readiness.
and we want to take a chance on them. And when I say take a chance it's going to be successful. For a lot of kids today, and we're working with Commissioner Holliday very intensively on the dual credit program for kids to earn college credit while they're still in high school. We have a scenario right now that we've built out that if a kid earns 15 college credits while they're in high school and then takes the balance of the equivalent of their associate degree at a community college and then transfers to one of our comprehensives, they can get a bachelor's degree and they earn, stay on 15 credit hours a semester. They can earn a bachelor's degree, and if they're eligible for aid, for Pell and the state aid, and they get the average amount of aid, not including institutional aid, they can earn a bachelor's degree for $150 a month. That's not bad. And if you, now that doesn't include room and board, that's tuition and fees. So we're working on these things. We're working with the campuses. And, at the end of the day, despite all the performance stuff, we feel confident. The real key is campus leadership. We're committed to working on these things. They'll happen. And if it's not, then we're lost in the world. Anybody else?
Bob and Ben are going to join us for lunch, so it'll be great as well.
I promised President Ransdell I'd come and speak this morning, so I'm going to stick to that and get to lunch. Thank you all for your time.
Thank you, sir. Thanks, Bob.
Before we break, I want to draw your attention to the last page of the agenda, the other schedule for the rest of the year. We've got commencement May 15 and 16, Finance and Budget Committee, May 29, special budget approval meeting, committee meeting, and May 21st, the adjournment session. And then third quarterly meeting, July, take up from there.
And we'll get details back to you about our budget approval meeting in June. And we're staff are working hard on that. Is it in the May or June? So that will be an important next meeting, and then we'll be working with you to put our agenda together for retreat and third quarter meetings through our committees. Mm-hmm. Down that. Thank you all. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Return.
I don't want to know.
I don't want to know.